Boiling Frogs Post presents Geopolitics with Ryan Dawson. Now, with the latest podcast in this series, here is Ryan Dawson.
Welcome back. Today's guest is Dr. Joseph Gerson, and the topic will be the geopolitical stage of the Pacific, and particularly China, the U.S., and Japan, the world's three largest economies. Perhaps the Cold War never ended in Northeast Asia. He's written a few books, Empire and the Bomb, How the U.S. Uses Nuclear Weapons to Dominate the World, with Hiroshima Eyes, Atomic War, Nuclear Extortion, and Moral Imagination, co-written with Walden Bellow. Dr. Gerson is currently the Director of Programs and the Director of Peace and Economic Security Programs for the American Friends Service Committee. His program work focuses on challenging and overcoming U.S. global hegemony, and he wrote a paper that's up on Foreign Policy and Focus and also antiwar.com called Reinforcing Washington's Asia-Pacific Hegemony. And I will explain a bit about that and give him the floor to give us a history of what is going on and why.
So, a little more than a year ago, Hillary Clinton announced the latest phase in the imperial hegemony called America's Pacific Century. The title has a disturbing resemblance to the Project for a New American Century, which gave us such horror shows as the pointless war in Iraq. In this Pacific pivot, as it's being called, the interventionists lay out a plan for the Pacific, and it's all about challenging China and controlling waterways. However, this is really an old, long-term plan going back at least to the Spanish-American War, you could say. Can you give an overlay of America's historical slow creep across the Pacific and what the broad plan seems to be presently?
Sure. You know, the U.S. was involved early on in terms of trade, whaling and so on, you know, in the early 19th century, the early 1800s. And at the time of the Opium War, when Britain basically invaded China, in order to deal with this balance of payments problems and to make it safe and legal to sell opium to Chinese. The U.S. ostensibly sat out that war, but in fact provided assistance for the Brits. And in the subsequent years, U.S., you know, some of the most wealthy families participated in competition with the British in terms of selling opium, largely grown in Turkey. And so you have families like the Forbes, whose fortunes were created in part on the basis of the drug trade. Interesting to note that John Kerry, likely our future Secretary of State, is actually a Forbes, so it gets interesting. By the 1850s, and it's interesting, there's the film out now, Lincoln, in which Seward, who was Lincoln's Secretary of State, plays a major role. A significant event took place in the 1850s when Seward is part of kind of the rising growth of power and empire here in the United States, and kind of the expression of manifest destiny, said that if the United States was going to replace Britain as the world's dominant power, we had to first control Asia. I was taught this actually many, many years ago when I was at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown. And at that time, you should appreciate that trade ships, warships were fueled by coal, and they required coaling stations. You couldn't take a ship all the way from San Francisco, say, to Tokyo, without stopping on the way, not only for food and other supplies, but for coal to get you there. But the reality was that the Spanish, the Brits, French controlled the islands, the stepping stones to Asia. And so that helps to explain Seward's folly, why the United States bought Alaska from Russia at the time, provided the northern route to Asia. Then you come to the 1890s, and I well remember the lecture that we had by Professor Jules Davids, who was in fact the man who was the principal ghostwriter of John Kennedy's Profiles in Courage. On the one hand, you had people like Admiral Mahan, Teddy Roosevelt, Henry Cabot Lodge, Senator, who had all been advocating the construction of a major U.S. naval fleet that could challenge Britain. And by the late 1890s, that fleet had been built. They took the Great White Fleet around the world as a display of American power. And at the same time, you had a great economic depression with the resulting, and more so than we have today, turmoil in the streets, strikes, a kind of, if you will, class warfare, where people who were out of work and desperate were challenging the system. And so U.S. leaders at that time and financial leaders concluded that, you know, if we could gain access, significant access to the China market, if you will, a holy grail of capitalism at the time, we could keep workers working in factories, run them 24/7, and this would, if you will, create what they called social peace, not to mention a bit of profit for the owners of these companies. And so with Spain, the declining empire, the sinking of the battleship Maine in Havana Harbor provided an excuse for the United States to go to war against Spain and to seize some important geostrategic locations. So, for example, in seizing Cuba and Puerto Rico, the U.S. gained total control over the Caribbean and thus access to and control over the Panama Isthmus and ultimately the canal. And in Asia and the Pacific, that provided the opportunity to conquer Guam and the Philippines, as well as to move ahead with the annexation of Hawaii. So with the Spanish-American War, the United States has created its the foundations for its overseas empire. It's interesting. Some years ago, I was in Ohio, and a friend, my host, wanted me to see McKinley's gravesite. I found myself thinking, why would I want to go see McKinley's gravesite? It's in a kind of a isolated part of the state. But it's really, I think, an important place. It's a huge construction. It faces west, and it reflects, which is to say toward the Pacific, and it reflects the kind of imperial drive and culture of the times. So that sort of gets us to 1900. And you had about the same time the Boxer Rebellion in China, basically a nationalist revolt against the colonial presence in a number of the principally the coastal cities in China. You had in those cities you had very much an apartheid kind of situation with the European and to a lesser extent Japanese colonists in control. The signs of no Chinese or dogs allowed kind of proliferating in the area. And kind of the Chinese pride led to a revolt. Then you have the United States, Japan, the colonial powers intervening. You have an interesting change in regional dynamics with the 1895 and 1905 wars. 1895 being Japan against China, and 1905 the Russo-Japanese War. In which Japan defeated Russia, principally for control over Manchuria and
Port Arthur,
northeast China. And coming out of that, we have Teddy Roosevelt, who moves to mediate between Japan and Russia. And essentially, the deal there is that the United States will recognize Japanese dominance in Korea in exchange for the Japanese recognizing U.S. dominance and control of the Philippines. So you have the, as one of my professors used to say, the practice of the rules of the game among mafia families. We'll give you a cut, we'll take a cut. And then in the period between essentially 1905 and through the 20s, you have essentially a period of collaboration between the imperial powers. You have the Washington Agreement in the 1920s, in which the United States, Britain, and Japan agree to the relative sizes of their navies in order to maintain, if you will, a kind of a grand bargain and stability among their competing empires. Then, of course, you have with Japan's invasion of China, a breaking of that that arrangement, and if you will, the most fundamental and untethered Japanese militarists and political leaders deciding to go, as they said, for the whole melon, and to do so, that led to the attack on Pearl Harbor, the war that followed, and the U.S. At the end of that war, controlling all of the Pacific, termed an American lake, and basic control over East Asia. And just to kind of wrap up this kind of historical review, one of the interesting things is that the new Prime Minister of Japan, Abe, his grandfather was named Kishi. Kishi was one of 26 Class A war criminals at the end of the war. 13 of them were tried, a number of them hanged, but 13 of them, including Kishi, were not brought to trial. The kind of interests of U.S. Power and attempts to transform Japan into a bastion against China and Russia in the Cold War led them not to prosecute him. And in fact, the CIA nurtured Kishi's career, making him prime minister at the time of the expiration of the U.S.-Japan military alliance, and in enormous, huge demonstrations in Japan, especially in Tokyo. In Japan, our 1968 was their 1960. Kishi forced through in the middle of enormous tumult and actually violence within the Japanese parliament the extension of that treaty. And it should be noted that the treaty was initially signed in 1951 in secret, as a term and condition for the United States ending the formal military occupation of Japan. Elsewhere in the region, you have the United States essentially creating the dictatorship in South Korea, kind of to match the North Korean dictatorship, and the United States rules through the Cold War as the dominant power, backing not only democratic governments but also dictatorships. And we have the absolutely notorious massacre of at least 500,000 people in Indonesia that had been given the green light by Henry Kissinger. So that's sort of a quick and dirty.
That is the quick and dirty of it. A good summary. A few notes. I did see Lincoln because I'm not that into chick flicks, but to note, the sinking of the Maine was initially blamed on Spain, which is what started that war, and yet it turned out that that wasn't the case. Japan attacked Pearl Harbor after the U.S. embargo on Japan's oil and after the U.S. sent cruisers into Japanese waters, which was part of an 8-step plan to provoke an attack, which was literally written out in the McCullen memo. And FDR and Admiral Kimmel allowed the punch in the nose not to start the war, because they could have done that anyway, but to annihilate the isolationists. And then, of course, 1968 was referring to Nixon in 1960 to Nobusuke Kishi, who was Yamaguchi Gumi Yakuza, openly mafia member, and became prime minister of Japan anyway. So that's sort of the macro picture. Let's get in a little bit more micro, narrow it down. I guess just in the past year, for 2012, there was a lot of back and forth politicking between the U.S. and China.
We've had a lot of island disputes that are old disputes. We've had a lot of arms being built up. Do you think the positioning the U.S. and China have been taking in the past year have ignited somewhat of a semi-arms race for the smaller states caught in the middle?
Yeah, I don't think we can call it a semi-arms race. I mean, we have a full-blown arms race going on. And, people who study international relations and some fairly senior figures in the U.S. government, people like Brzezinski and others, scholars, point to the dynamic of tensions that develop when you have a rising power and a declining power at the same time. Joe Nye, who was number three in the Pentagon in the first Clinton administration and really one of the prime authors of U.S. Asia-Pacific policy for more than 20 years, he's repeatedly lectured that when you have that basically twice during the 20th century, the dominant powers, which is to say Britain and the United States, failed to integrate the rising powers, Germany and Japan, into their world order, resulting in two catastrophic world wars. And his advice is that U.S. policy has to acknowledge the rise of China, but to do so in ways that maximize U.S. power and avoid a repeat of what happened in the 20th century. And so that has led to the policy that really begins in the Clinton era in the 1990s of simultaneous engagement and containment. The engagement is to draw China into the existing dominant world order, largely on U.S. and Japanese terms, and at the same time to contain it so that it doesn't transform the regional power relations and undermine U.S. power. So this is the foundation, of what's happening. It's really describe the boundaries and the principal forces going on.
And it's the small regions getting the really short end of the stick, places like Guam and Okinawa.
Absolutely. But also, also the people of Korea, the Japanese people in Japan, as the U.S. is pushing it increasingly to militarize. So you have the pivot is ostensibly traced to Hillary Clinton's article, but it clearly is rather more than Hillary. It's she was articulating the commitments of the administration as a whole, which is to say that as the United States is pulled out from Iraq and is drawing down in
Afghanistan,
it's pivoting its power to Asia Pacific. The strategic guidance that was adopted, I believe it was in late 2011, identifies the Persian Gulf and Asia Pacific as the two geostrategic priorities for the United States, also involving continued reduction of U.S. forces in Europe. And so you have plans to move to have 60% of the U.S. Navy, it's a nuclear navy, in Asia and the Pacific. And you have now the reports of surrounding China with stealth aircraft, F-16s, F-22s, and the new F-35. It's all part of what's called an airland battle doctrine.
I wouldn't worry about those last two. They don't even work.
don't worry about them now, but, in time, they're going to be pretty deadly. And you have of course the deployment of the Ospreys to Okinawa, and these are accident prone aircraft. And I saw a film maybe a month ago showing an Osprey landing in Okinawa, and the downdraft from those propellers is incredibly destructive. I mean, we just sort of think of them as ordinary airplanes, but it's a very destructive downdraft. We can spend some more time talking about that.
They're sort of a hybrid helicopter aircraft.
Yeah, when I heard helicopter, I used to think it was like a helicopter, but when you see what the downdraft from those propellers is, it's something quite different. But the other dimensions, and kind of coming back here to the pivot and its origins, the U.S. has essentially encircled China with military bases. I mean, a lot of these bases were there throughout the Cold War, but they've been reinforced, and the language of the Bush administration, Bush II, was diversification, slightly reducing the concentration in Northeast Asia and building more bases and what they call lily pad hubs for jumping off points, more in the South Pacific and around to the Indian Ocean. Now we've got we have access in Singapore. We are fully present in the Philippines again. 2,500 Marines just went to Australia. We've got the TASS alliance with India, a military relationship that the Vietnamese do not like to call a tacit alliance with Vietnam and around into Central Asia. Back in, it must have been 1998, I had an exchange. It was just before, just after Clinton had gone to China. And I had read it, I think, in Yomiuri Shimbun, that there was to be an NGO conference in Tokyo. The two U.S. NGO representatives were to be Ezra Vogel and Joe Nye, which is to say the former number three in the Pentagon, and the in the case of Vogel, the head of Asian intelligence for the State Department in the first Clinton administration, and they were to meet their equivalents from China and Japan, and I arranged to go and interview Vogel, and I asked, well, what's your goal for this meeting? And he said, well, to arrange a new grand bargain, a new security order in Northeast Asia. And I said, well, how do you do that? And he said, well, we threaten to surround China with missile defenses that can destroy all of their missiles. I repeat that, to destroy all of their missiles. And then we say, let's make a deal. I said, well, what's the deal? He said, well, the deal is that China doesn't adopt any more aggressive military doctrine and doesn't deploy any more aggressive weapons in its arsenal. And I said, well, that's interesting, but you know that leaves the hundreds of military bases, the nuclear-capable 7th Fleet, our international intercontinental ballistic missiles, and our dominance of the militarization of space all targeted on China. And his response to me was very revealing. He said, "So,
so
we have this going back to the Clinton administration, and then moving into the Obama era."
Some factions in China doing the same thing there with benefiting from the arms buildup as well? Because I just like, for example, we have these island disputes, which are very old disputes, but they got so much attention recently leading up to the elections in South Korea, Japan, and China.
Right.
And the media was – they're usually not in the media at all. And then suddenly they were uniformly even in the foreign media. And it just smelled like a kind of free Tibet or Joseph Kony type of thing where all of a sudden the spotlight is on these – they're not even islands. They're rocks, really. Nobody lives on them. And it's really not about the islands. It's about what's underneath them and the waterways around them. But I saw all of this, and it was the South Koreans and the Chinese going to the islands. And,
President Lee went and visited Takashima and painted a big Korean flag, and they're cutting the heads off of birds and wiping it up with Japanese flags. I call it Asia's Chick-fil-A.
And there was nothing in Japan.
And the response to South Korea's theatrics with the running around with the Olympics with the sign and all that was basically, oh, you have a dispute? Let's go to the international court. And South Korea wanted none of it. Well, that was that.
There were riots in China burning Japanese restaurants and cars and all this anti-Japanese sentiment. And Japan didn't bite on it because they're sick of the bases. They have protests all the time. And yet when Hillary – these all overlapped when the generals were visiting Japan and South Korea. When they came – they sold all of their gear, their Global Hawks to South Korea and the Ospreys to Japan. Amidst the protests, Tokyo just ignored that and bought all these weapons. And it seemed like, are they both feeding off one another? Because it just seems like the military-industrial complex on both sides really don't care about the peasants. I mean, they are making bank off of scaring each other with the other one.
Yeah. So, there are a lot of forces at play here. Once you have an arms race, it's mutually reinforcing, right? Mm-hmm. So when one side builds up, then the other sees that as offensive and tries to build new weapons to counter that, and you have a spiral, much as we had during the Cold War. So there's that dynamic is in place. You have military industrial complexes on all sides that certainly will profit from this. Not only in terms of money, but in terms of maintaining the privilege of those in senior positions. And you have in both countries, Japan and China, a growing nationalism that I think is really quite dangerous. So when you look particularly at the Diu Senkaku Island confrontation, I tend to read it a little bit differently than you do. I read it as in some ways almost rather, I would say, similar but different from the military coups in the 1930s that led to the creation of the militarist government and the 15-year war. I mean, what you had was an area where there is clearly, you know, disputed claims to these islands, which, as you say, on the one hand, are thought to be rich in terms of what's around the seabeds, oil, gas, and other minerals, but also important in terms of control of the waterways, again, as you said, and also airspace that China sees as critical should Taiwan move closer to independence, an effort, if they can control those islands and the waterways around them, the thought is that they can possibly bottle up the U.S. and Japanese militaries to prevent them from coming to the aid of the Taiwanese. So you have all these forces in play. Then you have the extreme right-wing governor of Tokyo, Ishihara, who is no dummy, and moves to say that he's going to, for the city of Tokyo, is going to purchase these islands. I mean, a totally provocative act.
From Japanese citizens who own them already.
From the Japanese ostensible owners. And to say the competing claims here, I mean, the Chinese, you know, mark claims all the way back to the 1600s. And I was in Japan in November at a conference, and it was interesting that former Mayor Iha of Ginawan in Okinawa went further than any other Japanese I've heard in saying that, you know, maybe the Japanese claims to these islands are superior to those of Japan. In any event, Ishihara knew what he was doing, and I think, you know, knew how the dominoes would fall in the aftermath of that action. Understood that it was a great provocation to the Chinese. This is, you know, kind of a you know, these are burning embers that should not be played with. And to try to calm the situation, Prime Minister Noda moved to buy them on behalf of Japan. But in the context of a Chinese political environment where nationalism increasingly replaces communism as a way to hold the country together, and where you have a growing Chinese military, you know, that provided the provocation to step up the crisis. I think we came very much to the brink of war, actually. The U.S. sent a very high-ranking delegation to both Tokyo and to Beijing, and we to this day don't know exactly what it was that they said or what transpired with that delegation. But we also had both the Obama administration and the U.S. Congress reaffirming commitment to enter a war on Japan's side against China. Should there be conflict over these rocks, so it's a, you know, I think it's a very dangerous situation, and of course with the islands dispute with South Korea, actually both Koreas, here you have a difficult situation where the possession of those islands is thought to be fairly essential to the identity of each country, and you know, the variety of games that get played out from there.
Yeah, Lionel Court. Well, there's two Koreans actually living on them now. But that one is a lot more neutral in my book. I don't see the Chinese claims on Senkaku as valid whatsoever by saying it was on ancient maps, because they really weren't interested in it. Even in the 1950s, they have them labeled with Japanese names on Chinese maps. It was after natural gas was discovered that they got interested in Senkaku. So, but I mean, I think you're right about Ishihara. I mean, he's crazy, and I would throw in Toto Hashimoto from Osaka as well. Those guys, I mean, if you think Abe is bad, it could be a lot worse. But Abe wasn't elected. I mean, he's a prime minister. They don't elect him directly. But that wasn't in reaction to the island disputes or China or anything of that. That was really people voting against Noda because of Fukushima. Yeah. I mean, basically, you could have run an animal. You could have run Richard Pearl or Dracula, and they still would have won because The JDP screwed up on Fukushima with TEPCO so bad that the LDP was definitely going to get back in power, and they reelected Abe. Nobody else wants to do it. Right. They've had a revolving door there. It seems like every 8 months they get a new prime minister. So.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I guess what I would say is that, you know, I view it as contested on both sides, and in terms of Senkaku and Daiwa Islands. And my sense is, you know, just looking at the human futility of the money wasted in terms of what could be used for you know, the social good, for revitalizing economies, for providing education for people, on and on. And the idea that countries actually go to war, I mean, it's just utter human folly. And I guess I think that the best way forward is to explore negotiations in the tradition of common security, to see how these regions can be developed to serve the needs of people in all the countries involved, rather than say it's the exclusive territory of one or the other.
Yeah, why not have a consortium and divide the gas fields? I mean, the natural gas became all that much more important to Japan after the disaster, because they need some source of energy after shutting down so many nuclear plants.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, if only everyone could act like adults, you know.
This is true. And, of course, you know, one of the areas that we haven't really talked about, but which is, you know, I think, really the becoming what Iqbal Ahmed once called the geopolitical center of the struggle for world power, is control of the what the Chinese call the South China Seas, but which, at least portions of which, the Vietnamese call the East Sea, and the Filipinos call the West Philippine Sea.
The Spratly Island dispute there too.
Spratly Paracels, you know, are part of it. That's where you have competing claims between China and Vietnam. But then you also have areas around the Philippines, and you also have conflicts with Brunei, Indonesia, and there's one other country involved as well. And you know, the Chinese have you know, reasserted claims to about 80% of this. They've been pursuing increasingly militarized policies to reinforce its claims, and the U.S. has taken advantage of this. By saying, look, well, you know, we'll protect you. We'll sell you more arms. We'll increase our weapons in the area to if you will, contain China. So that's a particularly tricky area, and it's important on the one hand, very important for you know, the, as you say, the oil, the gas, and the minerals in the area, but also this is the route through which the oil that fuels the East Asian economies has to come as it moves from the Persian Gulf and the Middle East to East Asia. So this is a critically important area.
Yeah, you kind of got onto my next question already, but I was going to say, you know, we've seen the U.S. pushing China out of Africa, such as the dividing and cutting off the oil in the Sudans, and then the U.S. is what I call the middle finger foreign policy to Russia and China and Syria. Do you think the Pacific could turn violent like in Africa and the Middle East? I guess you could add the Indian Ocean in there, well, given the tug of war over Burma and Myanmar. Right. I know Japan just gave today $5 billion loan to Myanmar, really just to hire Japanese companies to build infrastructure there. That's another possible pipeline to China. They've been building their half of it, and because they couldn't get the one in Pakistan to Iran for other reasons. Big tug of war over getting oil and energy sources to China and the Malaccan Strait. So that's the real issue with these islands, it seems. But do you think it could actually get violent? Because war with China, it just seems so insane, even for American plutocrats. I mean, that's just so
Hostile. Well, I think, you know, how to say this. I mean, I don't think anybody really wants war. But the reality is they struggle for relative power and do kind of shadow conflicts. The danger is there. I mean, I think, as I said before, I think we came to the brink last fall over the Senkaku and Diu Islands crisis. And, you know, political dynamics within countries sometimes can move to the point of being uncontainable, you know, where political leaders fear, if I don't move to this next level of reinforcing our military presence there or our interests, well, I'll be challenged politically. I mean, back during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was really the height of U.S. folly in terms of taking to the U.S. to and Russia to the and the world to the possibility of, as the Kennedy administration saw it, between a third and a half of having a thermonuclear exchange, which essentially would have ended life on the planet. In the middle of that, Kennedy turned to his brother, Robert Kennedy, and said, you know, if I don't respond militarily as I am, I'll be impeached. And these kind of forces can also come into play, you know, in Japan and China as well. At the same time, I think it's important to understand, and there's kind of recent repeated statements by the Chinese government to the effect that, look, they need a peaceful environment. The legitimacy, to the extent that it exists in China, of the Communist Party leadership there is that you have continued economic growth. And were there to be a war, say, growing out of the Korean Peninsula or in relationship to those islands, I mean, that would severely impact economic development, the quality of life in China. So, you know, it's an interesting area of tension where each side is reinforcing its military power, trying to demonstrate its power. And you know, the best that one can hope for out of this situation, if it continues, is that, you know, there'll be a demonstration of the kind of reordering of the relative balance of power. But on that subject, you know, kind of thinking in terms of Japan's relative decline, you know, I just finished reading the book Exposure about the scandal at Olympus, you know, where $1.7 billion just sort of disappeared. And it seems to me that you know, the Japanese corporate elite and some of the intersections with the Yakuza in some ways doom the Japanese economy to continued decline. Other countries have got their problems as well, obviously. In China, it's an issue of corruption, which may or may not be dealt with by the new government. We have problems here. But with so many Japanese friends, and, you know, having worked with people in Japan for a long time, you know, you can't help but be concerned about the need for real structural reform. And clearly the Abe government is just reinforcing old dynamics, you know, with the construction industrial complex.
Yeah, he's trying as hard as he can to crash the yen as well. I would mention the Yakuza, for those that don't know, he's talking about the Japanese mafia, and heavily, heavily fostered by the CIA post-World War II. Mm-hmm. We had the Kodoma scandal and Lockheed Martin using his intermediary to finance gangsters, etc. So that's how it works. But what do you think about the change of leaders? I know about Shinzo Abe, and we had him before, and supposedly he got sick, and his finance minister was in scandals, and there's a lot of things to talk about there. But for Park in Korea, or Xi Jinping in China, he was supposed to meet with Hillary and didn't. He was missing in action for about 15 days. Never did get an explanation for that. But how do you see the new leadership in South Korea and North Korea as well, I should say?
Yep, it's all changing. Well, in South Korea, you know, clearly it was a very close election, and what we have is the election of the dictator's daughter, reaffirmation of a conservative and militarist approach to policies, and it's not going to make life with Japan a whole lot better, not to mention North Korea. So it's problematic. I mean, Park, in her election campaign, said that she would attempt to re-engage North Korea, but to the degree to which she'll actually do that, you know, I think is in question. What's happening in North Korea, you know, it's always a question of what's really involved in the game here. You know, the recent missile test, which, you know, not only threatens Japan and the Western Pacific, but in theory, ultimately, not immediately, but ultimately, the West Coast of the United States, and apparent preparations for a third nuclear explosion. And these are all great concerns. at the same time, Kim Jong-un's New Year's statement was interesting in that he seemed to be reaching out to Park in South Korea to see what might be possible in 2013, which is the anniversary, the 60th anniversary of the armistice agreement. I mean, you still have a formal state of war. And you know, there's clearly been some behind the scenes dynamics going on with the United States. We don't know fully what they are. Reading this morning's New York Times, former Governor Richardson blanking out his name, the head of Google, had announced yesterday they were going to North Korea, and today's paper says that they're advised not to go. So there's some interesting dynamics at play. I have to say that in relationship to Japan, while it seems that Abe is going to hold his fire a bit in the months leading up to the upper house election so as not to frighten the Japanese populace yet again, his commitment to revisit the 1993 apology to the Koreans over comfort women is throwing oil on a fire, and one has to be concerned about the threat to move to revise the Japanese Constitution. I mean, the Constitution has been ignored and bended out of any integrity. Japan is now with the sixth biggest.
They base it off the U.S.
Sorry,
they base their Constitution off the U.S. and they treat it the same way.
Yep, but
not quite as bad. But
Article 9 has imposed some limits, even as Japan has become the sixth biggest military spender in the world and is thought to have, behind the United States, the most advanced navy in the region. So deep concern about where Japan is going and what that means in relationship to other East Asian nations and the kind of opening of the of the deep scars that are there. For its failure to really face up to the 15-year war. In China, it's an interesting game. I mean, we have a new government. Clearly, it's confident of its surging economic and therefore political and diplomatic power, investing more in its military. You have the dynamics of a Chinese military that has increased in power and influence within China, so that's not encouraging. On the positive side, the question is how deeply Xi Jinping will go in challenging corruption within the Chinese political system. Much as here we recognize the U.S. economy as the greatest threat to the U.S. people. In China, it would seem that the corruption within the system is the greatest threat, and they've articulated that. But whether they'll really go after it is another matter.
Well, yeah, Hughes, chief of police on trial for murder and the finance minister. I mean, it's a fiasco there. But Xi Jinping used to live in Iowa. He used to live in America. He used to study agriculture.
Right. Right.
It's an interesting bunch, but Lee from South Korea was born in Osaka, Japan. It's weird. It's so strange to me that the U.S. would get all bent out of shape about oil pipelines and waterways and those kind of economic things, but the gross human rights violations, the massive sweatshop labor and virtual slavery all over China, and taking North Korean migrants and saying, oh, you're not refugees, and just deporting them back to North Korea where they get murdered. All that gets ignored. But, if it comes to a worthless rock and who gets to sail by it, then, they're willing to shoot each other over that. Yeah. But China's such a large trading partner with the whole world that everyone looks the other way, no matter what they do or how they treat the people. They've got empty cities there propped up so that the speculators don't lose money. Everything's got nasty. I'm just trying to balance all of this out. What – this is my last question because we're running out of time. But
stemming off your example about JFK and the pressure he had put on him, with all these new faces and players and with Kerry coming in.
And Hillary coming out. I don't really see many other changes. We have a shuffling of the generals in the U.S. Mm-hmm. What would be the best case scenario to scale back, at least preventing violence in the Pacific?
Yeah, well, I think we shouldn't place too much hope in any change with Kerry coming into a greater degree of power. I mean, this is a guy who voted for the invasion of Iraq, even though like 95% of the people here in Massachusetts who were communicating with his office were saying don't. And as recently as 2011, blocked or rather voted against a Senate resolution saying that the invasion had not been justified. You know, he's for a long time, you know, been quite a militarist.
Well, he's directly tied to Interceptor Armor and Natech. He procured them the $5 billion for the digital camouflage and all that mess.
Yeah. So he's right there in the system, and you know the military is not about to change either. I mean, I think the reality is that you have deep economic and other interdependence with China. I think it's best the U.S.-Chinese relationship has best been described as competitive interdependence, and I think the popular level. We need to be, I think, pressing that rather than spending money for weapons and militarization on all sides, that this is money that we need for our children, for investment in infrastructure in our society, and for the betterment of our lives. And I think that's an important approach to take in confronting it, looking at people's very very real self-interest. Mm. I think the other level. Which is a lesson I learned from a man named Kinhide Musukoji, a really great Japanese scholar and human being. The most important is to find ways to build webs of relations between people on all sides to the point where we make the idea of actually going to war impossible. I think this is particularly, it's a challenge, obviously, between Japan and Korea, Japan and China. But very important, and we're trying to do our best here in the United States with an organization called the Working Group for Peace and Demilitarization in Asia and the Pacific, and there are other initiatives as well. But I think most important is for people to kind of learn the issues and talk with friends and find ways that you can contribute to peacemaking rather than sitting on the sidelines and letting these crazy machinations really undermine the quality of our lives and raise the possibility of war.
Yeah, and not bite into that back and forth reaction to nationalism, because during those island disputes when that was all over TV, people I know, regular people who I would never have dreamed would get into that, were all of a sudden so mad at Korea or so mad at Japan, and I'm like, what are you doing? You know, are you really falling for this? You know, are you really going to become I don't know if you call it racist or xenophobic or whatever, but prejudice collectively to everybody over you know, what these extremists are doing. But it's hard fighting the press. That's why we have radio shows like this to combat what's on the television. But we are all out of time, and so I really appreciate it. I'd love to talk to you some more. I got a bunch of other questions, but thank you so much for explaining all of this today. It was wonderful.
My pleasure, and I hope to meet and work with you down the line.
I will be certainly interested in that, and I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Check back soon for another episode of Geopolitics with Ryan Dawson, exclusively here at BoilingFrogsPost.com. We'd like to thank you for your support of our work and invite you to share it with friends and ask them to support it as well.